You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Hello there, and welcome to the Daily Detroit Happy Hour Podcast. I'm your host, Sven Gustafson. Today, we're coming at you from the Happy Hour at the beautiful Queens Bar in downtown Detroit. We got a great guest for you today, Drew Philp, who just came out with a new book called A $500 House in Detroit, Rebuilding an Abandoned Home and an American City. It was released April 11th and published by Scribner. Philp, you may know, he gained notoriety after penning an essay, a lengthy essay for BuzzFeed in 2014 about buying his home in the Poletown neighborhood in Detroit in 2009. And he lives there now with his dog, Gratiot. And Drew, nice to have you on the pod. Nice
to meet you. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, great. So just kind of first of all, I'll start off with congratulations on this is your first book. And how do you feel?
Thank you very much. Yeah, I feel great. I'm really glad to have it out in the world. I've been working on it for about 3 years or so since that BuzzFeed story came out. And I'm really proud of what I made. So I hope everybody reads it.
Yeah, great. And you've managed to quit your day job at some point along the way. So things got to be going pretty well, I guess.
Yeah, I do some other journalism stuff and some other writing. So yeah, this is my primary.
Great. We'll get into that a little bit. And that's a good seg. Let's start by talking about your path to becoming a writer and before we get into the talk about the house and everything. You grew up in Adrian, Michigan, small little town out in the country. You went to college at the University of Michigan. And you worked for the Michigan Daily, right?
I did, yeah. And they really taught me how to write. That's where I really learned what was what to do. You know, when I went in there, I was like, I had no idea, honestly. Like, I was writing newspaper stories with only 3 paragraphs in them, like the essays I'd written in high school. And they were very kind to me, and they sat down with me, and they said, okay, this is how you do this. And they really taught me how to write. From that, I got an internship at Bakersfield, California, which is, in my opinion, one of the best, like, small to medium-sized newspapers in the United States. It's family-owned, and they just kind of let me run wild and do whatever I wanted. So from that, I was able to kind of begin doing some more magazine stories and written some films for a local company, things like that.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that later. And I also wanted to just mention that Dwight Yoakam had a great song about Bakersfield. Did you ever hear that?
Oh, yeah, totally. Oh, yeah, Bakersfield, like, that was like the... I kind of talk about Bakersfield as like the Detroit of the West.
Isn't it like a chemical factories or something there?
It was oil and farming.
Yeah, but like a fertilizer companies. I mean,
there's probably something. I don't remember that one exactly, but it's like fits in with their like MO. They were great. I mean, Bakersfield's great. Like, but the country music out there was fantastic.
Yeah, and so you've been doing freelancing for a few years now, I think, right?
Yeah, it's been quite a while now. I don't know how many exactly. I've done a lot of stuff. I mean, you know, the classic, like, writers, you know, worked in construction, worked in bars, worked in restaurants, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's all great material for being a writer, right?
Yeah, and just you got to pay the bills, too. So, yeah, I've been doing it for a little while now.
So tell us, how did the book deal come together? Like,
so after the, on the strength of that essay, which was like super viral, right, I got an agent, and that agent went and sold, I wrote a book pitch, which took me about 6 months or so, maybe a little less, maybe 4. Wrote a book pitch, got it real tight, and then it went to auction. So he took it to a number of publishers, and they purchased that at a live auction, basically.
That's great, and Scribner bought a bid on it.
They did, yeah. So, yeah, they them and a number of other companies. Yeah.
So let's kind of talk about the house, you know, your home project. Tell us kind of the abridged. I know it's a long story and everything, but tell us the abridged version of how you came to find this house.
So when I was graduating college, what was it? I guess I wasn't graduated yet. I moved to the town before I was finished with school. I used to actually like hitchhike back and forth, which was kind of wild. But I wanted to like stay in Michigan. because I saw at least like half of the U of M graduates were leaving the state.
And this was kind of like mid-aughts
time frame? Yeah, like 2007, 2000. Yeah. I think I actually graduated
in 2008. So pretty grim time economically here.
Oh, yeah, certainly. And everybody was leaving the state. I come from a fairly like blue-collar family, like working-class family, and I felt really lucky to get the education that I did at U of M. Obviously, it's one of the best schools in the world, and I wanted to use that for something at home. So Detroit made sense. So I just kind of moved to Detroit with no friends, no job, and no money, and just tried to do it. You know, I found a job in the newspaper, actually sanding floors for $8.50 an hour. And it seemed to make sense. So, you know, like when I was doing that, I was seeing all these houses that people were buying or renovating. And I was like, hey, maybe I should try to do this too. And so I ended up moving to the Polletown neighborhood and kind of looking for a house. Like at the time, there, you know, you could throw a stone in any direction and hit an abandoned house, right? And so we would just kind of ride our bikes around. A gentleman I lived with, whose name is Will in the book, we just kind of ride our bikes around and look for stuff that looked good. You know, kind of go into the abandoned houses, see if what the condition was, you know, how much stuff was stolen, and I finally found one that I was really into. So,
and tell us about the house, and you know, give us the specs, how many bedrooms, everything, but also the condition it was in when you found it.
So the condition was wild. I took about 10,000 pounds of trash out of just the first floor. It had no windows, no plumbing, no electricity. There was a, I think I described it as a pornographic hole in the roof. It was pretty nuts. On the like, kind of level of abandoned houses that you can, you know, like feasibly repair, it was pretty much one of the worst. There'd been not really any big fire damage or anything like that. So,
like, any idea how long it had been abandoned?
It had been abandoned for at least a decade. Just kind of open to the elements. From what I can gather, what my neighbors told me, like somebody, you know, 10 years before I got it was trying to rent it out. Nobody really liked them. So, you know, I came back one day and all the windows were gone. So it had been abandoned for quite a long time.
Right. So it was filled with 10,000 pounds of trash, as you mentioned. Obviously, that was the first thing you had to tackle. But then, I mean, you've got no electricity, no windows, no plumbing. Where'd you start?
So I lived with a neighbor just a couple blocks away. This neighborhood in the book I call Forestdale, which is like a very special neighborhood within Polletown.
But that's not the real name of the neighborhood, you said, right?
It's not the real name of the neighborhood, no. Because, you know, people want to be kind of left alone there. Yeah. It's like part of my story, so it kind of intersects with this, right? But, you know, people just want to drive their tractors and, you know, raise their kids and farm their stuff. But it's kind of, you know, run loosely by this man, or started by this man named Paul Wirtz, who is a teacher at Katherine Ferguson Academy, which is formerly the school for pregnant and nursing mothers. And he started a farm program there, and he also started a bunch of kind of farming stuff on the east side over there in the neighborhood. So this block was like really populated. There may be like three or four houses gone on the whole block when, you know, it was crazy. It's wild, like kind of what this man was able to kind of hold together. So I was staying with, I was staying with a friend there. And, so I worked on the house for about a year before I actually moved in. But even when I moved in, it wasn't in that great condition. I still had no heat. I lived without heat for almost 2 years, not quite 2 years. I kind of carved out a little area in the back, like a little studio apartment within the house that I could live in and begin doing it. Because I did it without grants or loans or anything like that. So it was just whatever I could, you know, scrape up from, you know, working at a restaurant and then kind of doing construction or whatever odd jobs on the side to pay for, you know, 100 feet of electrical wire or, you know, a couple sheets of drywall.
Right. You write about being hired as the only white guy in an all-black construction company. Is that where you learned everything about construction, or did you have to turn to contractors at any point?
No, so the only thing I had someone do on the house was I had someone put on the roof, not because I can't do it, because I've done plenty of roofs, but it was actually cheaper than me and like my buddies doing it. So I could just pay to have it done less expensively. But I come from I come from a fairly blue-collar background. I think my uncle builds houses, my grandfather builds houses, my father was a machinist and taught machining and built a lot of his own house. So, you know, like when I was growing up, I never saw a plumber or anything like that. So it was just kind of a natural fit. You know, if I had a question, my dad was in my pocket and I could call him. And I'd grown up, you know, like when I was 13 or whatever, tearing the roof off my dad's house and putting it back on. So it was a pretty natural
fit. Did you salvage all the materials that you used? I mean, did you end up going to like Home Depot or something like that for some things?
Oh yeah, you know, like things like wall covering or electrical wire, you can't really find around, you know. I mean, I guess with wall covering you could, but you know, I bought drywall and things like that and insulation, you know, you can't. But a lot of the stuff I did, you know, there's beams in the house that came from you know, this factory down the street that looked like it had been in the bombing of Dresden. You know, there were no walls left, kind of thing. So a lot of it is, you know, as much as I can. My cabinets came from the Chad C. Condon School, which was torn down, which some friends of mine with the construction company kind of got us in there for, you know, like we got a day to take as much as we could. I filled my truck up with cabinets, and they just pushed it all on the ground, man. It was crazy. It was wild, you know, like this is like beautiful old growth oak, and like, I mean, these cabinets are amazing. And they just, you know, giant slabs of marble that, you know, they just don't make anymore, you know. This is beautiful carpentry, all kinds of stuff, and they just push it all into the ground. We got a day. My countertops are from, I think, the old Faygo factory. I think that's correct. A friend of mine pulled them out of there, and I traded him some work or some material for them at some point.
It's got to be pretty cool to you know, go around your house and go, yeah, that came from a factory, that came from, an old school. And I mean, there's a lot of, like, sort of history in your house.
I mean, that's kind of the point, right? There's, like somewhat of an ethical concern about, like, I mean, with the Chad C. Condon School, but, like, you know, I don't own this beam. I don't own this building. It's, like, this giant trash heap down the street. Like, technically, it's not mine, you know? But on the other hand, it all gets pushed into the ground.
So right, it was all going to either rot or get thrown in a landfill or something.
Right, you gotta save this stuff too to kind of keep the history alive of what it was and where it goes, and they become conversation pieces like you're saying, so we can talk about the history and what's gone on here, you know. Like, I mean, yeah, sure, the Chad C. Condon School is outdated, but why couldn't we strip it of all these things first and use them somewhere else instead of just cutting down new pine trees to make this stuff, you know? I mean, we've done it a different way that's much more surgical and thoughtful, I think, at least, you know.
So you bought the house in 2009, and when did you actually move in?
Also in 2009.
And then, so it was the construction...
Oh, excuse me, no, I guess it was... it must have been 2010, because I bought it in October 2009. It must have been 2010.
Okay, and then how long did the construction, you know, reconstruction take?
Oh, I mean, it's still going on, right? Yeah, I mean, you know, like, the house is stable and nice, and, like... it's all cosmetic at this point, but like the skin on the outside of the house hasn't been done. You know, like that's an enormous project that needs to get taken care of all at once, probably. Most of the rooms are done. You know, like I'm working on my office. The second bathroom is done. Guest bedroom is more or less done. So, I mean, it's still happening. I'll probably never be done with it. You know, like you kind of see little things you don't like, and like if you do it all yourself, you end up doing it over, you know?
Right, right. We're talking with Drew Philp. He's the author of the new book, A $500 House in Detroit, Rebuilding an Abandoned Home and an American City, on the Daily Detroit Happy Hour podcast. Also want to give a shout out to Queen's Bar for hosting us today. So you got, what, two bedrooms in this house, or two bathrooms, rather, in this house?
So there's two bathrooms. One was added later at some point. It's obviously been added onto the house. The house, I believe, was from 1903. If I'm remembering that correctly. So, like, it's gone through a lot of...
house, I think, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's gone through a lot of iterations. I mean, there's a lot of history there. It's more than 100 years old, so they didn't have, you know, running water. There's probably an outhouse in the back somewhere buried. You know, they didn't have running water. They didn't have lights. I have gas pipes running through all the walls because they didn't have electric lights at the time, right? So the house at one point was it's huge. I mean, five or six bedrooms. I can't really tell because it's been so kind of carved up. But there are three actual bedrooms right now, an office that was probably two bedrooms at one point. And then at one point, there was probably another bedroom downstairs adjacent to, well, it might have been a living room. I don't know what it was. So maybe four.
What's the square footage approximately?
You know, that's a good question because I didn't go through any kind of realtor or anything like that. I have no idea.
You own it outright.
You know, like, I bought it from the county auction for $500. At the time, it was a live auction where I like held my little bidder sign up, you know?
Were you the only bidder?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they were going through pages. Does anybody, you know, there are 20 properties per page or whatever, 12 dozen properties. Does anybody want anything on page 400, you know, 451, whatever? Yeah, so I was the only bidder. But so it's like a lot of these things of like kind of people think they're normal about houses. You know, I didn't even know how to find the address, right? Because there's no like numbers on the house. So you got to figure out for, you know, like when buying it, I first had to figure out what the address was, you know, and that's
how'd you do that? Like look up old plats or something? Like,
so yeah, so I went out down to like the GIS mapping department at the city, and they made me like a map of the block with the parcel numbers and such, and I was able to figure it out through that. And it's, you know, like there's kind of these weird things about, you know, I didn't know what the address was, right? So I, yeah, you know, I have no idea about the square footage.
That's crazy. But it was a Queen Anne
style, yeah. Okay. It's like kind of rambling, you know, there's turrets, there's no real central hallway, it's two stories.
Yeah.
It's not a perfect Queen Anne, but it's pretty close.
Right. So you've been, you know, building this, working on it, construction projects for like, what, 8 years almost, going on 8 years now and everything. I mean, just from the strictly construction side of things, would you do it over again if you could go back and relive your life?
If I could be 23 again, sure. I don't think my body could take it right now. You know, I put in my time with the no heat and with the kind of, you know, just brutal, hard on your body construction work. It's hard on your lungs. You know, there's all the dust.
Well, and you were working without heat in the winters and everything.
Oh, yeah. So if I could be young again, sure, I'd do it again. But would I do it now at 30 or almost 31? I don't know.
So you're not looking to franchise this model?
I don't think so. I mean, it was a great thing to do when I was that point. And my dad and I will probably, there's an abandoned house next to me. And my father and I, if we're able to buy it, I've been trying to buy it for years. The city owns it finally. I've been trying to buy it from them. If I can buy that, we'll probably redo that house. And it's in about the same condition as mine. We'll rent one of the apartments out at market rate and use that to support the other apartment, which will be for like a refugee family.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. So you've written a lot about this, but I want to let you kind of talk about it. And that is the experience what this experience has taught you about the city of Detroit and the neighborhood more specifically.
Sure. I mean, you know, I guess when I came here or stayed here or whatever, that...
I mean, when you were in college and everything, had you spent, and growing up in Adrian especially, like, had you spent much time in the city?
I hadn't spent, I mean, I was kind of a punk, right? So you'd come up to, like, St. Andrews for punk shows and whatnot. So I spent some time in the city, but not, you know, like, not in the neighborhoods, right? I wasn't, like, hanging out in Poletown for sure when I was in high school. And a lot of people in Ann Arbor didn't come to Detroit either at the time. It kind of seems strange now, but it just didn't happen, like... These kind of two cities real close to me. So I had spent some time here, but when I moved in, I really, like, didn't know anybody. I just moved into an apartment. I think I was paying less, like, $125 a month for my apartment in Midtown that didn't have a kitchen sink. It was kind of wild, so I didn't know a whole lot. But, you know, like, after being here for almost a decade now, it's like, man, there's 700,000 people that live in the city. And that community that I was taught... is, you know, kind of has all these pathologies. I don't know. I don't think that's true. I think that what I've found, at least, is like this kind of strong, resilient community that's very brilliant and very resourceful and very different than elsewhere, too. I mean, my neighbors look out for me and I look out for them. You know, in a place like New York or Brooklyn, like, you don't even talk to people in the elevator, right? You know, you don't say hello. There are 700,000 people here, and they have their own ideas for what they want Detroit to become. And I think we have an incredible opportunity to make Detroit, like, actually into the city of the future, where things are much more equitable for people, where we still, like, have this kind of sense of community, and we don't go the kind of, you know, Brooklyn model where it gets too expensive for everybody, where...
Gentrification,
and but also just this kind of, like, when everything is valued with money, right? You know, like, it's so expensive, and money, you know... Money is the bottom line to everything. I think we have another opportunity to kind of go in a different direction from most of America, where we value other, where we place higher value on other things that are not dollars and cents.
Has your neighborhood, Poletown, has it changed just in the time since you've been there?
It has. I mean, like I was saying, he used to be able to throw a stone in any direction and hit an abandoned house. There are not many left because of fire, because of demolitions, and because other kind of like young white people coming in and buying houses.
And it's mostly white people coming in and buying houses?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's either, you know, like white folks coming in or kind of older or elderly people, you know, kind of very established people in their middle age, kind of hanging on to their houses that they love very much. Many of my neighbors have owned their homes for generations in some cases, and certainly decades.
So a lot of older people in the...
Yeah, there's a lot of older... And then, you know, kind of the, like new white folks moving in too. There's obviously a lot of space in the neighborhood, so it's very desirable for people that want to do farming. Like they kind of do the urban farming thing. So that is happening too, but it seems like it's being, you know, as much as possible being kind of cleaned out so their more traditional development can come in, because we're, you know, I mean, I'm a bike ride from the baseball stadium, you know, it's like a 10-minute bike ride from the baseball stadium. I can just about throw a stone into Eastern Market, so it's certainly not going to stay Prairieland forever. I think there's some serious kind of investment on the way.
Yeah. I mean, I know, like, Eastern Market has got eyes on that neighborhood for its own expansion.
Oh, yeah.
Among probably many other entities.
And they're putting, I mean, Eastern Market is putting money into the market right now. You know, they got all the streets torn up and the murals in the market kind of thing. I mean, there's some serious money looking. Because, I mean, kind of we're the mirror image of Corktown, right? Across Woodward. It's about in the same location that, you know, Corktown or Woodbridge would be. but the housing stock isn't there, like, in those neighborhoods. So it seems like it's coming down the pipeline. You know, they're demolishing all kinds of structures there now.
So you talk about how there's a lot of kind of younger white people moving into some of the older homes in the neighborhood and probably fixing them up. And then you talk also about the neighborhood dynamic where, you know, there's a lot of people who have lived there for many years, and many of them are certainly black and everything. So how is that, like, are the new people coming in, is that, how's the dynamic working with the kind of older neighborhood? Are they integrating, like, smoothly? Is it...
I think for the most part, yes. From what I've seen, and I can only speak for just my neighborhood, I think people are trying really hard to do that. And I don't necessarily know if everybody comes in with that intention or understands what that's going to take, but I think kind of through just conversation, people want it to happen. I don't know if people always know what the best way for that is to happen, but it is happening. And I'm actually, like, pretty relieved and feeling good about that. You know, like, we're talking about, you know, like, people with much more societal power, using that power to keep their neighbors in their homes, you know? Like, for example, I bought my neighbor's house from the auction and gave it back to them when their house is being foreclosed upon. So there are things like that that are going on, too. I don't think anybody's really being pushed out because the neighborhood was, you know, there were lots of houses in the neighborhood at the time. It wasn't like folks are buying people's houses. And there is a distinct amount of shaming that would happen and does happen if people attempt to do that. So it's strange. You know, gentrification can't happen here like it can in somewhere like Brooklyn because we have so much space, right? There is this kind of cultural gentrification that's going on, too. Like, young white kids are getting a lot of attention and, like, all this, like, myself included, right? So it's different. It's happening different. But I guess I'm hopeful that there is kind of room. You know, like, when you live next to somebody, when you live right next door to someone, it's hard to see them get kicked out of their house. You get to know them, you know. Yeah. It's not just this statistic or, like, a black person, right? You know, it's your neighbor.
Yeah.
So
in a neighborhood like yours,
right,
there are eyes and ears that help.
Oh,
know,
yeah, absolutely.
Protecting each other's.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a kind of symbiotic relationship, right? So I do think people are looking for ways to kind of help one another out more often than not. So I am hopeful about it. What I'm more worried about is the large money that sees an opportunity to make profit, right? Most of the people I see coming into my neighborhood are like me. They just want a place to be in the world, right? They want a home for themselves. They might want to have a little farm and, like, raise their kids, right? Which is what everybody in the neighborhood wants and does. The scary part is, like, when the big money comes in that has no conscience, that, you know, is willing to just kind of wipe everything out, like, which happened with the Poletown plant, you know, for a thing that might not, one, benefit Detroit, and two, might not benefit anyone in the neighborhood at all.
So you've written, and you know, correct me if I'm not capturing you correctly, but that, you know, you when you started out on this, you were kind of, you know, you were this young guy, fresh out of college, or not even really necessarily, and you thought, I have a chance to kind of help save Detroit or be part of the solution. Do you still sort of feel that way?
You know, in some ways it's a like loaded question, right? But yes, in some ways I do. But I think that involves me amplifying the voices of people that have been here for a long time. So I think we all have a role to play. And those of us with more privilege, I think, can use that for leverage and kind of help support the community that's here in a number of ways, with money, for example, or time. But I don't see it in the same way where I'm like, hey, I'm going to come here and fix Detroit, right? That involves way more listening now and me, you know, like supporting things other people want to do. I've only been here for like 10 years, you know. Some people have been here literally for generations, and they probably deserve more say in what's to happen with the city, and I think we need to support those things.
So I should also mention that, you know, we're talking about your new book. You've got a book release Friday, this Friday, this April 14th. So sorry if you're listening to this podcast after the date, but it's at 7 p.m. at Trinasov.
Trinasov's, 1464 Gratiot Avenue in Eastern Market.
Right. Great venue. We wanted to mention that. So you've also got, you know, kind of moving away from just the house story, which is certainly very interesting on its own, but you've done a lot of other stuff. You mentioned before that you've written feature-length screenplays, essentially.
For a gentleman in town, a company in town called Noggin Films, and I wrote, I think, two films for them that, you know, that I was paid for, and they were on contract and such.
And these are like, you know, like, were they documentary style?
No, they were like one was a horror film, the other one was a like straight up drama. So yeah, they were, you know, like totally kind of original.
Were they made into films ever or not yet?
I believe they're still trying to work on one of them now, but neither of them have been produced as of yet.
Okay. Also, reading from your site, I found this really interesting. In 2016, you were an 11th hour food and justice fellow at University of California, Berkeley, where that program was apparently run by Michael Pollan, the famous food author, the guy who wrote In Defense of Food and Eater's Companion. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. Michael Pollan is a great guy.
Yeah. Right? I've read some of his stuff. He's really interesting.
You know, I was kind of like nervous to meet him or whatever because he's this towering figure in literature right now. He's a great guy. But he runs, along with some other people, Malia Wallen and some other editors, run a fellowship at the University of California, Berkeley, about where they give fellowships to young writers and audio producers to work on things concerning food and justice. And I am doing a project where I'm looking at the... It's looking at kind of Recovery Park Farms, which they're calling one of the largest farms in the, or excuse me, largest urban farms in the United States, which is coming to Poletown. And they have massive plans for expansion. I think they have like 105 acres or something. Don't quote me on that one, but it's quite a bit, expanding to 350 in the neighborhood. So it's an enormous farm.
That's like, and transformational,
so,
yeah.
It's huge, yeah. And so I'm my project is looking at that. And other people did projects about all kinds of stuff, veganism in Israel, food fraud, things of that nature.
Interesting. You've also hitchhiked. You mentioned, I think, hitchhiking back and forth from U of M campus to Detroit. But you've gone across the country that way.
I've hitchhiked all over.
Really?
Yeah. It's a nice way to travel, especially when I didn't have any money. You know, like I'm broke for so long.
Yeah, and you don't worry about the safety, you know.
I mean, I'm a white male. It's not really difficult for me. I mean, I had a girlfriend that would hitchhike all over too, by herself. I think it's a really good way to kind of affirm your faith in humanity, you know, because like you're standing on the road all day with your thumb out, then somebody picks you up and gives you a ride that you don't know. A lot of times people buy you lunch, stuff like that. So it's actually a really nice way to get around and to meet interesting people, people that you probably wouldn't interact with in, you know, your daily life. Because there's just kind of no way to do it, but yeah, I've gone all over. I totally encourage everybody to go hitchhike.
Never had any creepy hitchhiking experiences.
You know, not really. It's a much longer story, but okay. There was one time I was a little bit worried, but other than that,
all right.
It's been It's been pretty weird.
Right. So you've got the book release party again Friday 7 p.m. at Trinasoft's on Gratiot in Eastern Market. What's next for you? You're freelancing all over the place. It sounds like
I'm freelancing. I am. I got some irons in the fire right now in terms of like journalism work and another book potentially. And films and stuff. So I got a lot going on. Nothing I can talk about specifically right now. But I hope you will be seeing more from me in the near future.
And as do we. So, well, thanks a lot, Drew Philp, for coming on the Daily Detroit Happy Hour podcast. It's been nice to chat with you. Drew Philp is the author of the brand new book, just came out. It's called A $500 House in Detroit, Rebuilding an Abandoned Home and an American City. It's available from Scribner on Amazon or your favorite brick-and-mortar bookstores, which they still exist, and they're worthy of your hard-earned dollars. So that's going to do it for our show today. I'm Sven Gustafson. As always, it's been a pleasure. Don't forget to share us on your favorite social media site. Check out DailyDetroit.com for more great content. And as always, be good, do good work. And take care of one another. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.